For you right now at 5:30, something new is happening at the DMV starting today. You'll have a new option if you don't identify as male or female.
Some days I would feel extremely masculine, and some days I would feel like extremely feminine, and that's when I started to notice that something was up.
I am non-binary, which means I have no gender. I am just me.
Non-binary to me means freeing yourself, not just living here or there, but embracing all parts of it.
And I ask, why does it matter to you if I don't identify as a boy or a girl?
Hi, I'm Matthias, and this is V1&O, the show where celebrities get cerebral. On today's episode, Finn Argus learns about the history of gender queerness. Today's media outlets will often report on gender queerness as if it's new to society. And to be fair, this is somewhat understandable because Gen Z, which is representative of anyone born between 1997 and 2012, are the quote-unquote queerest generation yet. According to research from Gallup, one in six Gen Zers above the age of 18 consider themselves queer or transgender. In the past decade, there has also been a 60% increase in people who identify as LGBTQ+. A majority of these people identify as bisexual. Another important thing to mention is that gender is who you go to sleep as. Sexuality is who you go to sleep with. Being gay has nothing to do with your gender, technically speaking. Being trans has nothing to do with your sexuality. With that said, what we're seeing on the news is merely representative of the fact that people are more willing to communicate or even just explore their genderqueerness than they have been in recent times. The actual concept of genderqueerness is one that is as old as time and has been far more prevalent in past times than it is now. So what are some examples of genderqueerness in ancient civilizations? When did we start to see erasure of these people throughout history? And how does this history affect our relationship with gender today? That's what Finn would like to know. Finn Argus is a 21-year-old singer and actor, although their birthday is just around the corner on September 1st. I say they because Finn uses they-them pronouns, refusing to fully subscribe to the two quote-unquote traditional genders of male or female. Despite years of modeling, acting, and making music, Finn recently gained nationwide exposure with a role on Peacock's Queer as Folk reboot. Finn also continues to make music, with their latest single, Exposure, out wherever you stream music. Our specialist on today's show is Eric A. Stanley, who is the author of Atmospheres of Violence, Structuring Antagonism on the Trans/Queer Ungovernable, and the co-editor of Trapdoor, Transcultural Production and the Politics of Visibility, and Captive Genders, Trans Embodiment and the Prison Industrial Complex. They are currently an associate professor in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. Enjoy the show. So I did not like really have the pleasure of meeting you, but I was at the V Magazine shoot and just had like a very quick hi and bye. You seemed like super comfortable doing a fashion shoot, and I wonder if you have always been as comfortable in front of a camera working with stylists and everything like that as you have been doing TV and film and everything else, because they're really two different beasts, right? It's really not the same thing to be modeling essentially and acting.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's definitely a lot of overlap because at the end of the day, it's still a performance and you have to perform to a camera. And I've spent my whole life being in front of a camera because I am a bit of a ham. But yeah, I don't know. I used to do like e-commerce modeling when I was growing up. I've just been doing photo shoots for so long, but over the past handful of years, I've finally gotten the opportunity to do stuff that's more fashion, more editorial, and I just get to have fun. And honestly, that's all I do.
Yeah.
I think there was one photo shoot in particular. It was for Behind the Blinds with Nino Munoz, and he just wanted me to have fun. So I was just doing like Tai Chi on the beat. And then I saw those photos and I loved them. So I'm like, okay, great. The answer is to just have fun in these photo shoots. And then that translates for the most part. And so that's what I was doing for the V shoot, which, by the way, was so exciting for me, like, obviously, but when I was 15 and I moved to LA, I signed with Ford and they were like, you're a musician, you're an actor, you're a model. You could get a spot in V and like, it'll work. There's synergy. And I was like, oh my God, that would be amazing. And it was my dream for like years and years and years. And then when it finally happened, I don't know. I mean, I was over the moon. It was so cool.
We were too. It was a surreal thing, I think, on all ends. It was just like a really fun day on set. You know, I can tell you that's not always the case for us. I'm sure it's not always the case for you either. Sometimes it can be like, yeah, people have different sort of creative things that they're going for. Maybe the talent is not, yeah, in love with the styling, or like, you know, whatever it is. It went really smoothly. And I mean, sort of related to what we'll be talking about more later, one of the requests we had from you and your team when we were putting the shoot together was to both have like men's clothes and women's clothes basically there on set. And they were very like, right, Finn wants to sort of play with whatever. I assume that wasn't necessarily the case back when you're doing e-commerce, right? Like, this is something that probably later you've been able to start asking for. So can you talk about sort of like that transition into being able to be a little bit more like playful, mm-hmm, with the clothing and everything, and you know, why that was something you wanted to request, because obviously it worked out perfectly.
Yeah. So weird that there's not more non-binary representation at Kohl's.
I know. I know.
I mean, that was so long ago. I think what really helped me start exploring my own gender and like my presentation and wearing clothes of all types, regardless of gender, that was probably when I would just get hand-me-downs from my older sibling, Sadie. I was like, wait, why are girls' clothes so much cuter? Like, true, what's going on here? I feel like I'm being cheated.
Yeah.
You know, I walk into the men's section of a store and it's like cargo shorts and a blue t-shirt. And like, honestly, fierce, like, live your truth. But I was like, no, I want some patterns. I want some frills. So that was the start of it for me. And I think over lockdown in particular, that really helped me realize what I wanted to wear and like who I am, regardless of outside perception. I was no longer presenting for anyone else. And I found that I did want to wear dresses and I wanted to wear skirts and I wanted to present more feminine. And I think that was the beginning of me like really understanding my transness and non-binary identity.
Do you feel like you have kind of maybe a decent grasp on some of the history of like what we're going to talk about?
Yeah, it's definitely something I've looked into. I'm super interested in queer history, and then specifically, you know, because I can relate to it, like non-binary history. And there's no shortage of non-binary existence in humanity in all different like sectors of the world. And I knew that. And so I'm just curious to find out more of the minutiae, like the specifics. And it's a very natural and human thing to exist outside of gender binary. And I know that that has been sprinkled throughout history. And I'm familiar with a little bit, you know, like, mostly I've learned about non-binary gender expression throughout history through Alope, who is an author and a poet and a public speaker and just a, you know, a really smart person who posts a lot on their Instagram and writes books about the gender binary and how that was sort of used as a tool to control people in a way.
Yeah.
So to me, like non-binary represents like just gender queerness in general represents liberation, like true self-liberation. And that's how it's felt for me. And I know that throughout time, it's also had that same impact.
Yeah.
I'm curious to learn more. I'm excited to learn about the specific.
If you can talk a little bit more just on a personal level, because we will be talking about it from a historical viewpoint, but on a personal level, what this new mindset or like opening up your own life to, whether it's clothing or whatever it is, of just not really staying within this strict binary, how that has affected you career-wise, mental health-wise, what other changes has that brought about?
I mean, the world isn't made for people outside of a gender binary. I mean, at least where I live, where I've grown up, the world that I've experienced firsthand is not made for gender queerness.
And where did you grow up, by the way?
I grew up in the northwest suburbs of Chicago.
Uh-huh.
It's a little town called Des Plaines. It's cute. I love my family. I loved growing up there. It's also very conservative and religiously oriented. And life outside of a gender binary is not a thing there.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't even know what being gay was until I was in like fourth grade. I was 11 and I was like, huh?
Yeah.
Who? What?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I was told I was gay before I knew what gay was. And then I was like, that does check out. Does check out what you're saying, actually, come to think of
that
it.
No, literally, it was like people, this is like boohoo, but whatever.
Right.
Like, I got bullied in school because I was more feminine, you know, I was just being myself. And people were like, oh, gay. And I was like, huh. Yeah. I didn't know, but I'm like, yeah, I mean, true. You're right.
true. I think that the idea of going beyond, you know, being gay or straight or that spectrum, which is one sexuality, it's still relatively new, I guess, is what I'm saying in a way. But also what we're going to talk about is how it's also not new at all.
Yeah, it's not new. And also, I do find that they're kind of inextricably connected too, like gender and sexuality. I think there's a reason that those conversations are always connected. And, you know, we're a part of the same acronym.
Yeah.
LGBTQ+. Because when you think about it, sexuality does oftentimes have a lot to do with gender. Not that it's controlled by gender, but I think it's informed by gender a lot of the time.
Yeah.
I've also been curious about those intersections because as I've come into my own genderqueerness, then that begs the question. So, okay, am I gay? Or like, what does that mean if I'm not a man?
Right.
It's an interesting concept. And I don't know the answer, but I just use the word queer for all of it. I'm just queer. And like, whatever happens, happens.
V1&O is sponsored by Yuke's, the one-stop destination for art and fashion. I love Yuke's so much, and it's not just because they were a first ever sponsor for this podcast. They actually have an amazing collection online. Head to yukes.com and see for yourself. I mess up on this podcast all the time. Some of it you hear, the rest of it you don't. That's thanks to Citizens of Sound, a one-stop shop we use for all of our podcasting needs here at V1&O. Citizens will help you with conceptualization, branding, production, editing, and distribution. So whether you're an artist, an actor, or you just think you have a compelling story to tell, podcasting might be the right route for you, and Citizens of Sound are here to help. Head to their website, citizensofsound.com, for more information. Eric, thank you so much for joining us. I'm wondering if you can just start by giving us a little bit of information on yourself and what you do academically, what you've written about.
My name is Eric Stanley. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. I'm the author most recently of a book called Atmospheres of Violence, Structuring Antagonism and the Trans Queer Ungovernable from Duke University Press. And perhaps most importantly, I'm a community organizer that works at the kind of intersections of trans liberation and prison abolition. So that's what I've been up to.
Well, first of all, hello, Eric. Thank you so much for taking the time. I appreciate it. As a genderqueer person, I've been trying to do my research and understand where we've been sprinkled throughout history. So I'm excited to learn more about it. And for you, would you identify with the phrasing genderqueer, or what feels good to you?
For me, I identify as genderqueer, as trans, as a kind of shifting set of terms. What about you?
Actually, same. Yeah, it's sort of this moving target. And whenever I try to put my finger on a word, it like doesn't feel right by the time my finger lands. So I err on the side of just using the word queer, all encompassing. And my gender is very fluid. And every time I try to, I'm like, these are my pronouns. I'm like, actually, she's feeling pretty good today. But, you know, it's anamorphous. I am an anamorphous blob of queerness.
Sounds good.
I'm just curious, for someone who's like spent so much time and energy studying, what does the phrase non-binary or genderqueer mean to you?
Of course, I should begin by saying that there's no single or universal definition. Mm-hmm. However, one way that we might attempt to understand non-binary is that it holds together many who don't firmly exist within the fiction of the gender binary. Mm. And by gender binary here, I mean the kind of system of punishments and rewards that attempts to violently, and that's important, that attempts to violently place us all within the discrete categories of man or woman.
Right? Yeah.
And some people find home there, and that's beautiful and that's rad. But I think we need to create the conditions so that 1,000 genders can blossom. And to me, that's the kind of liberatory promise of trans and non-binary identities.
When did you start coming into your own gender queerness?
I think that it's something that I've always lived within and sometimes against, right? In this anti-trans and, you know, rigidly binary world, I think that we're constantly attempting to navigate all those systems. In the last, 20 years, I think it's been something that's been more present in my life. But my own queerness and my own gender queerness is something that's really structured my entire existence, as it does all of us.
Right. Same here. I mean, I've always been gender queer, but I just didn't have the vocabulary for it.
Right.
And then, of course, that vocabulary shifts. Mm-hmm. What is an example of how that definition shifts for different people that you've noticed?
Language is always historically contingent, meaning that it's of its time and also culturally, racially specific. And so terms are going to move and shift around. Something that is considered a slur in one moment then becomes reclaimed by communities. For example, the word queer, which historically has been understood as a slur. And now from the late 80s, early 90s on, it has been a term that we've claimed for ourselves within the community. And so there's a bunch of different terms that circulate around. And so for me, I think it's important to kind of operate through an ethics of gender self-determination, meaning whatever someone identifies is what they are. And that's the end of the conversation. So I think that that's always really important.
Absolutely. Because at the end of the day, it's no one's business but their own. It can be this thing that shifts. So, you know, those painting or pictures where you have to kind of unfocus your eyes to see it? That's sort of how I feel about genderqueerness.
Yes, yes.
Eric, just to follow up on a question that Finn asked, I think we grow up in like such a structured world that some people, the thought never even crosses their head that perhaps they don't just have to be a cis, hetero, you know, whatever it is. And so, yeah, I wonder if you read something, saw someone on TV, what that was for you.
I think to me, actually, understanding my own gender has always come through political organizing, right, around other trans and non-binary people, especially folks that were much older than me and growing up in bars and clubs and on the street and things like that, meeting people that had an incredibly expansive understanding of themselves. And I was like, oh, wow, that's so magical and that's so beautiful. And they've opened up so much space so that I can understand the world in a really different way. You know, there's people like Miss Major, who's a close friend of mine that has done so much of that work. Those are the worlds that enabled my world to unfold.
My experience was similar. Like I had really come into understanding my transness on my own, but I was lucky enough to spend the last year surrounded by just the most incredible trans non-binary folks. And it opened my world up and it really offered me a newer and fuller way of existing. And it was so fun.
Oh,
you know, I really felt myself come to life in a way that I had never before. And that's what community does. It's really beautiful to see trans folks lift each other up.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think freedom is contagious.
Definitely.
I was curious, in my experience, when I've talked about my gender queerness or not existing in a gender binary with like family or like, you know, there are a lot of people who don't understand it and find it to be this like brand new idea, this sort of fad. But of course, gender queerness has existed throughout history in a lot of different places. So are there any specific birthplaces or just like cultures and communities where gender queerness is prominent throughout time?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a really important question. And for me, whenever I'm thinking about gender, I always start, especially here in the context of the United States, with the question of colonialism, right? Mm-hmm. Because at least here in the United States context, we have to think about, you know, the relationship between something that we might call settler colonialism, which is essentially, you know, white Europeans attempting to steal the entire world from indigenous people. And along with that, we have to have a really deep analysis of chattel slavery and its many afterlives, right? And so that's my important place of departure for even understanding the gender binary system so that we can then get to gender queer identities. And I say all this because, you know, the gender binary is one of the brutal weapons of colonization, right? It's a racialized project. It's a racializing project. One example, I'm talking to you all today from San Francisco, California, which is also Ohlone land. And Ohlone scholars such as Deborah Miranda has written extensively about the multiple gender systems that were operative in her tribe pre-contact, right? And also how those practices are still lived in our current generations of Ohlone people, right? So it's not just something that exists in the distant past, right? It's an ongoing practice in Ohlone communities. You know, there's lots of places that we can find something that might be referentially non-binary. And I think that's an important project. Also understanding it within its own context and its own history. So we're not just like looking for versions of ourselves in the past.
Yes.
So kind of complicating that while we're also doing that work. I think that that's important.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, my experience could never be related to that. It's really cool to see that there are existences outside of the gender binary in all these different communities.
Eric, could you maybe give like a couple other examples? Because I think that's really interesting. I think it's really easy for people to think like, oh, this has existed before in the exact way we're starting to exist it now. But actually, there's always the specific cultural lens that we have to look through that, you know, we can't necessarily understand if we're not a part of that culture. But I just wonder if you have other examples of that.
I'm an Americanist, which means I work on the United States. So that's the history that I know the best. But, you know, we can also just think about the history. You know, there's writers like C. Riley Snorton. He has this really amazing book called Black on Both Sides. And he thinks about the history of Blackness in the United States, specifically around the question of trans and non-binary identities. I mean, so that's a kind of theoretical and historical look at the ways that anti-Blackness has actually, you know, been one of the major tools of the gender binary. And so then there we can see from his archival research, gender expressions that are vastly outside of the binary that have existed throughout history in the United States.
When you were bringing up colonialism or whatever it was, I mean, why was it seemingly in these groups' best interest to essentially try to extinguish these ideas that had existed long before, and in North America's case, before like the Europeans came? Why was that something they were attempting to do at all?
You know, colonialism is an incredibly brutal system of essentially destroying someone's world. And so one of the ways you're going to do that is by destroying someone's culture. So it's about, you know, limiting gender expression. It's about stealing language. It's about stealing customs, right? In an attempt to shrink someone's capacity to relate to themselves and to each other. That's one of the reasons why the imposition of the gender binary, as we now understand it, was so central to colonialism.
It's curious that, you know, we're at a point where in America, I, as a trans non-binary person, can like get an X on my driver's license. Like, how did we get there? Are those tools still active, those tools of colonialism? And I know the answer is yes, of course. It's just interesting to see these incremental changes that include life outside of a gender binary. And does that actually push the needle forward, or is it more symbolic?
So I think people having access to documents that reflect our lives is really important, right? Because we all know all the different ways that we're asked for papers and our, you know, daily existence. So yes, definitely that.
Yeah.
However, you know, and I write about this some in my book, Atmospheres of Violence, I get a little bit worried that we sometimes mistake inclusion into these systems as the end of the system itself, right? What I think we need is the end of borders, not more capacious passports.
Right. So what does that look like, you think?
I mean, I think that we're attempting to do all these things at one time. So yes, we need to push for more expansive governmental ideas. At the same time, we need to demilitarize and perhaps destroy the borders itself. So we're not kind of caught up in this system of constantly being asked for our papers to be known from a kind of governmental institution that knows nothing about us, right?
So for example, in this case, it would maybe be having an ID that doesn't have any mention of gender on it whatsoever, instead of saying male, female, X, etc.
Yeah, that could be one example. Also thinking about like where and when we need IDs, right? The proliferation of the biometrics of identification itself, right? It's a really recent occurrence within the last 20 years. All the places that you're ID'd that you used to not be ID'd. I mean, you know, I remember when you weren't ID'd to get on an airplane. It wasn't that long ago.
Also not that long ago, like you didn't even have photos on IDs. My dad like drove his friend's car all the time and would just be like, oh, I'm so-and-so, because there was no photo. This is not that long ago, all things considered. So yeah, I guess you can function that way. It's interesting.
I mean, that's one of the kind of beautiful histories of the trans underground, when people would just make their own identifications and switch each other's past, you know, use each other's driver's license or switch out the pictures when there were no pictures, you know, and you could actually write on them.
Okay, that's pretty neat. Hey, this is who I am. Bada bing, bada boom. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So with changes like this happening on identification cards, like, while of course, like that is important, there's simultaneously so much anti-trans legislation being pushed. So how are those things coexisting? Like, it just doesn't make sense to me because it just feels like there's this symbolic change that's happening. And even in the media space, you're seeing so much more trans non-binary representation, which I love. But simultaneously, it almost feels like pacification because of all of this anti-trans and anti-queer legislation. And where do you think that's coming from? What are those laws? Who are they targeting?
I mean, that's an incredibly important question. I think you answered it, but I'll try to expand it some. So yeah, one of the things that's really interesting to me and that I think we have to really grapple with is the relationship between inclusion or assimilation, right? The kind of expansion of identification at the same time we have the expansion of violence. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that one of them negates the other, that as we become more included and more quote unquote represented, we'll somehow find freedom and less violence. But that's not actually the case and has never been the case. And so then we're kind of stuck in this set of contradictions and we're just trying to like search our way out. And I think that that's our historic moment that we're in right now in our political moment. You know, and I think that we need new tools and new vocabularies to really understand the complexity because some of the old formations of, you know, if there's more trans people on TV, then we're less likely to face violence. Like we know now that that doesn't actually work. And so what are the things that we want and need? Because as you rightly said, right, in the last year alone, there's been about 300, probably more than 300 bills circulating in the United States that specifically target trans or gender nonconforming people, right? At the same time, we have all these trans people on TV or in the media. And so figuring that out seems really important.
I'm almost afraid to bring up this question, but I'm hoping that it makes sense, which is, I also, like you were talking before about, you know, whatever anybody says they are as an individual is sort of how they should be respected. And I just want to always refrain from basically grouping people together. And anybody who's maybe listening to this who's really unfamiliar, I think it's important to say that not all trans people necessarily see everything the exact same way. And there's a lot of divergence and things just even within the community, whether you're trans or queer, whatever you want to say. Because I think oftentimes people, again, will group something and say, oh, well, my Black friend says this or my whatever says this. I'm not trying to bring up fights within the trans community, but basically I'm wondering if that's fair to say, Eric, and if maybe you can expand on that also so that not everyone's opinion kind of gets grouped, you know, based on how they identify.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, identities are not politics, right?
Right.
Even in someone's lived experience, you know, we all have such vastly different relationships to the world. And so, of course, we're not going to end up thinking or believing the same thing. There's as much divergence. Sometimes it feels like more within the quote unquote trans community, whatever that might be, as there is from trans people to non-trans people, right? I mean, I think that that's an important point to always underscore because it is how the world is.
It is.
Well, yeah, no, I'm just curious, like, because visibility in like TV and film isn't actually the thing that's like affording trans and non-binary folks safety in their daily life. Like, what is the way to shift the population's mindset around the binary that has been a part of this country's inception and used to control people for so long? Like, how do we actually shift people's mindset away from that?
I mean, I think that for me, I'm always really invested in material structural changes, right? And I think that that material structural changes actually change the culture that we live in, the anti-trans culture that we live in. So, you know, for me, that looks like free housing for people, free food for people, ending the prison industrial complex, ending street sweeps of houseless people. All those things are actually at the center of what I think will make the material changes that we need for trans and gender nonconforming people. You know, and right now we have a system that believes that if, again, if you have like a couple of prominent trans people, that that change will trickle down. But I actually think radical social change only comes from the bottom up. And so I think that's where the world that we need is actually going to be born.
Right. Is that why you mentioned the place that you first came into your own understanding of your gender queerness was community organizing through politics? Do you think that's something that people should consider getting more involved in?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that there's lots of trans and gender nonconforming people in all kinds of organizing spaces. There's also lots of anti-trans organizing spaces, but there are, you know, you can find your way in them. And if you can't, you can make your own. And I think that that's really important. It also is a space to build community. And that's one of the things that we are really lacking. And I think that, you know, struggling with people figuring out something in a room is a really actually good way to also figure out, you know, your own gender, your own sexuality through understanding the world with other people.
As we mentioned in the beginning, you can stream Finn's latest single, Exposure, now. We will also be linking out to Eric's books in the description beneath the show. Also, I'm going to start shouting out our new subscribers. If you guys want to hear your name on the show, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and then send a screenshot with your name to v10@gmail.com. You can also send us suggestions for guests, topics, specialists. Tell me about your day, whatever you want. So, a very special thank you to Stephanie Yanko, Dasha N. Lau, Noah Castro, Jonathan McInnes, Naomi Nail, Niall Nail, Karina J., Elena Gofredo, Sean Cook, Dam Liborio, Subin Han, Covey, Lula Steele, and Bernard Thomas. Again, thank you guys so much for subscribing. V10 is produced by Ryan Killian Krause and myself. Our editors are the people at Citizens of Sound. I'm Matthias. See you next time.